We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Arteta! What a strike!
It's Bukayo Saka's world, and we're all just living in it. This is the Arsenal Vision post-match podcast. My name is Elliot Smith, the Good Buckman, Twitter, Yankee Gunner. Look, I don't have an inflatable unicorn, but if I did, I would be riding it in honor of our hero, our savior, our young rescuer of all things dark and evil, Bukayo Saka. He is the joy of the football world right now, and certainly the Arsenal world. We're going to talk about Bukayo Saka, maybe a little bit about England too. And we're going to do that with Tim and Paul, but we're not going to do that just yet, because first, we're going to do it with Andrew Mangan. You may know him as Arsblog. That's where you can find him on Twitter. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Elliot. How are you?
I'm good. I want to talk about Bukayo Saka, but first, we have limited time. I'd like to devote a good chunk of it to really digging into William Saliba. Kidding. So one thing you told me, you won't hang
out of here.
Bye. Have a good one. No, I'm kidding. We're not going to bring anybody down like that. We're going to talk about the man who strides the world on an inflatable unicorn, and that is Bukayo Saka. Yeah. Look, I don't know where you are on the rooting for England or not rooting for England thing, but it's been, you know, a hell of a journey for England in the Euros, and I feel like maybe I'm too much in the Arsenal bubble, but I feel like Bukayo Saka has been a big part of that story. I mean, in terms of just the way this kid seems to be infectious with the joy he brings to people, the way he can just have this sort of quiet confidence that he exudes without coming across like a prick, like some young Tyros can. He's a real joy. And for me, I mean, he's been the thing that's made this tournament come to life for me.
Well, certainly from an England perspective, you know, where I am on the rooting for England thing is complicated. Obviously, I'm very well aware that, you know, I'm an Irish guy who supports an English team. But, you know, there's a little bit of history between Ireland and England, and certainly between England and the rest of the world when it comes to sporting things. But I really love to see Bukayo Saka do well. And I think the fact that he has become part of this, what I think is a really exceptional England story, all things considered, when you think about what happened pre-tournament, the sort of opinions of Gareth Southgate, you know, all the stuff that was going on before the tournament. The fact that he has become a big integral part of it, I think, is great. You know, I love to see it. I think a lot of people listening to this, and I know it's my experience from speaking to people who became Arsenal fans in other parts of the world, did so on the back of big tournaments. Like they saw Dennis Bergkamp at World Cup 98 or something, and that goal against Argentina. And they were like, what? Who is this guy? I love him. Who does he play for? Arsenal, cool. I'm in. Mm-hmm. And I think there might be some of that going on with Bukayo Saka as well. If he isn't generating a whole new generation of Arsenal fans across the world, there's something wrong. It's just brilliant, isn't it? And it's wholesome and it's good. And we, you know, how do I say this? We can get caught up, I think, sometimes in the minutiae of football. Like every small, tiny little thing matters. And sometimes we lose sight of the fact that a 19-year-old on the pitch doing what he does is basically the most joyful, wholesome thing about football, and we should all enjoy it. It's great. I think it's great for him. It's obviously great for England. It's been great for the tournament. And ultimately, I think it is going to be of benefit to Arsenal, even if it may have an impact on the start of next season from his perspective.
You know what's unusual, though, is like just the likability and that sort of quiet confidence, but quiet joy. Like, because, you know, there are the pictures going around of his teammates carrying him around after the game, and everyone in the camp seems to love him. And I think of like some of the brilliant young players Arsenal have had. Cesc Fabregas, who I think for both of us is one of our favorite Arsenal players, was a prick, but he was our prick. Jack Wilshere, spiky as hell, but I loved him because he was ours. Saka doesn't have that. And sometimes I fall into the trap of thinking, oh, if you're a nice player, you won't make it the elite level, that you have to have that spikiness. But you watch him, you know, up against the touchline, turning a defender and bursting past him. And, you know, the little darting runs in behind and the way he feels confident taking a man on in a semifinal of the Euros. He plays like someone who would have that sort of spiky confidence, but he doesn't have that aspect to his character. Is that sort of a unique thing for you? A player who's sort of this uniquely calm and quiet and likable, but exudes that confidence on the pitch?
I don't think it's unique. I mean, I think there have been footballers who've been very good and also very nice. I think sometimes we get mixed up in this idea that talent plus genius equals flawed character. And that's often the case, in fairness, in many sports.
Samir Nasri is waving at you.
I think I used the word genius there, Elliot. So don't throw that name in there when
Look, he gave us one of the genius moments of my life, the Drip Doctor's Twitter night. So that's still one of my favorite memories.
Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that. Okay, take it back. But look, I think he is a very... how do you say it without sounding patronizing, that he's a very well brought up young man, you know, in the sense that he's well mannered. I think somebody was saying last night, I saw on Twitter, that when he came off last night, he said thank you to Gareth Southgate when he was coming off the pitch, you know? And most players, or a lot of players, would be like throwing a huff or something like that. Mm-hmm. I just think he's a very decent, respectful young man who I think is always going to be like that. He's got a precocious talent. He's way ahead of where he probably should be in terms of his development as a player. Just something I was talking about on the podcast today, which will be out tomorrow at some point, Friday. Just the fact that he has always seemed to be able to skip an age level. He's like a little maths genius, you know, the 12-year-old who'd get called up to Harvard or
Doogie
whatever.
Hauser. Yeah, we had a show called Doogie Howser. He was a doctor at 14.
I remember Doogie Howser. Yeah, so he's like footballing Doogie Howser. That's what he is. And, you know, you don't have to be an asshole to be really good. And I think that is something that can connect with people as well. You know, there's a lot going on in the world that isn't great, and there's a lot going on in football that isn't great. So to be reminded that, you know, you can embody all the things that we like to think are important in a way a person is and behaves and views the world, and also be really brilliant at football like Bukayo Saka is, I think that's something that we can all kind of get on board with, no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is, you think about the battle for the right side attacking forward position at Arsenal between Pepe and Saka, and you will not see a more quiet battle in history, because you have two people who, from a character standpoint, are extreme introverts from the outside looking in. Maybe not introverts, but at least quiet, well-mannered guys. I do wonder, I mean, I think this can cut one of two ways. Having a really good, exciting summer tournament where you go to the final for a young player can build character, bring you back with immense confidence, and get your season off to a bang. But it can also mean that you don't get a full preseason, you're a little bit tired, and the other players start a bit ahead of you. And so I'm sort of wondering, looking ahead, we have this interesting situation developing in Arsenal where Saka is obviously the star of the future, certainly looks like it right now. Hard to see how that wouldn't be the case. But he also has a very expensively acquired, very talented partner on the right-hand side in Pepe, an academy kid in Smith Rowe who sometimes plays on the flank, right? You know, maybe another player being acquired there. And then another young Tyrone Martinelli, who's going to get a full preseason that Saka won't. So how do you see this cutting? Because by the time he comes back and gets a bit of a rest and is ready to start playing, those other guys, the Pepes, the Smith Rows, the Martinellis of the world, will have been playing preseason, maybe have even started Premier League games that Saka might have been held out of. So does it springboard him to a much better season, or does it maybe potentially mean that he gets off to a slower start in your view?
Well, look, I think he is going to get off to a slower start. What I would say is that I think Saka is already a first name on the team sheet player for Arsenal. Okay. When he's fit, he plays. Now, where exactly he plays, that's the million-dollar question for me. And that's something I'm really interested to see next season, because you say, you know, he's competing with Pepe on the right, and he may well be, but it strikes me that if we're going to try and harness what Pepe did towards the end of the season, you know, leaving him out for Saka while playing maybe somebody not quite as good on the left doesn't make a lot of sense if Saka can also play on the left. I'm fascinated to see what the plan is for him and where he might end up. You know, we've seen him play left back, left wing back, left side of the front three, right side of the front three. Occasionally we've seen him play as a sort of number 10. We reckon, and I think it's quite obvious, that he could play as an 8 in a 4-3-3. So where he ends up, I think, is going to be really, really interesting. And I wouldn't want to pigeonhole him. What I would say, though, is that Arsenal have to think about Bukayo Saka's medium to long-term future when we start this season, because he's been off the back of a huge season. You're a guy who counts the minutes that players play, and you know that only Granit Xhaka played more outfield minutes than Bukayo Saka last season. He's now gone into an international tournament. He's been training. He's been playing. This kid is going to need a rest, and that's going to hurt us because, you know, he's one of our best players. And that's not something that you can do without when you're going to play a newly promoted Brentford and you're playing Chelsea and you're playing Man City. But the reality, I think, is that if we're going to manage him properly, we are going to have to give him a break, give him some holidays, let him come back. I don't think it's like the old days where if you don't get preseason, you're absolutely ruined. You know, he's not going to go on his holidays and eat all the fish and chips and the burgers and come back 2 stone overweight. You know, that's not what preseason is anymore. It might be what you or I would do, but finally,
I don't just do that in preseason. I can do that all season long. Trust me. I can stay in that shape year round.
Here's your sister. but you know, it is a case, I think, that we're going to have to be careful with him, because we don't want, I mean, what is the only thing that can stop Bukayo Saka? And that's injury. And we don't want to be stupid or careless. As much as we might need him in some of those games, we're probably going to have to sit there and, you know, bite our hands, you know, and think, we'd love to have Saka for this game, but the best thing for our season might be, you know, to leave him out. So I think that is something that Mikel Arteta is going to have to reckon with at the start of the season. England have gone all the way to the final, so Saka is going to need a break. I don't think it's a case that, you know, whatever happens, you know, I hope whoever does play, whether it's Martinelli, although he's going to the Olympics, Smith Rowe, Pepe, you know,
did
whoever.
Did he get picked for the Olympics? For some reason, I thought I saw that he actually didn't wind up making the team. Did he make it?
He did at first, and then he's been called up again. So he's going to be...
Are we letting him go?
Yep. And if Brazil go all the way, then the final is on August the 7th, and our first game is on the 13th of August. So that could be his preseason, but maybe if he's coming back from Tokyo, he's going to have to isolate for a couple of weeks or quarantine or something. I don't quite know. But look, I don't think there's any danger of Saka losing his place because others are going to play in the first two or three games of the season. That's where I think when he comes back, someone else makes way simply because he's so good.
Yeah, it's a shame for Martinelli because he is a player who I now think moves into more of that. How do we find a way to develop this extraordinary young talent in light of the players we have in positions that he wants to play? And I think that is going to be a real challenge for Arteta this season with no Europa League, because I realize there are people that maybe aren't as high on Martinelli as I am. I think it's in there, and I think it's our job to unlock it. And I certainly think if you say, how could Arsenal be exceptional in the coming seasons? Well, one nice shortcut would be for Saka, Martinelli, and Smith Rowe to all be stars. Right. And we have to find a way to get that to happen. So let me ask you, I mean, if you had to look at this group, let's say we do buy someone like an Awar, and we wind up with an Awar, Smith Rowe, Pepe, Saka, Martinelli, how do you see that hierarchy in terms of so-and-so might get 25 starts, so-and-so? I mean, you don't have to list each one, but do you have sort of, let's say we want to play the 4-2-3-1. Now, it might be a 4-3-3, which changes that a little bit. Let's say it's a 4-2-3-1, and Aubameyang's up front. how do you see the hierarchy of that group? Because you really have, I would say in that scenario, two for each position sort of competing.
It's a great question. I mean, I don't know at this point because, you know, it's hard to know what we're going to do in the transfer market. I'm beginning to get a little bit antsy, but of course, you know, there is still time. There's a month to the new season and there's, you know, August 31st is the transfer window.
Players are in training.
Yeah.
But started.
It's difficult to deal in hypotheticals like this because you're assuming that in every game, we're going to play the same 11. I don't think that's the case. I know it's a little more difficult this season because we're not going to have Europe, and consistency of selection is going to be something that I think Arteta is going to have to lean into, assuming he can find something that works, right? In terms of a hierarchy, I don't know.
Other than Willian, who's at the top, of course. Well, from down from there, yeah.
Of course. Look, if we sign an Aouar and Smith Rowe is there as well, I mean, I think Smith Rowe can play a lot from the left. I think some of this will depend on what happens with Lacazette. Mm-hmm. So if it's a case that Lacazette goes, do we buy a striker or do we use Martinelli as our you know, Aubameyang alternative / partner? You know,
I
that kind
for
of
that, yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't be averse to that either. And then you have Pepe, Smith Rowe, Saka, and Aouar, or whoever the signing might be, you know, to back them up. And that's like four players for three positions. So it's relatively easy to see how everyone would get game time in that scenario.
Mm. I mean, do you think then, as a result, this could be a season, given there's no Europe, where someone who we might in other seasons have kept at the club has to go out on loan? I look at Balogun and I think you want him playing 30 games a season, at least 40 games a season. And I don't see how he gets anything resembling regular time for Arsenal this season. So is he someone who might have to go out on loan versus other seasons where he might have stayed?
I think so. Like if we were playing Europa League and we had a similar kind of group like last season, you know, of course you keep Balogun and you play him in those games. Mm-hmm. We don't have that. We don't have the luxury of that. And there's a lot of pressure this season on results. You know, we've got to be performing this season. We've got to make sure that we're in the European conversation at the very, very least. It's another situation that I'm quite interested in because, you know, he was basically going as far as everybody who was in the know was saying, look, this guy's going to go. He's got all these offers. It doesn't look like he's going to stay. In fact, it looks more than likely he's going to leave the club. And they've talked him into staying. And I want to know how. I want to know, like, how do you sell it to a kid like that who had options? He could have gone to Germany. He could have gone to a number of European clubs. And I'm sure he could have gone to a number of English clubs who, you know, Brentford probably would have taken him because I think they did make a bid. Sheffield United made a bid for him as well last season. So what have they said to Balogun about either his pathway or his development schedule? You know what I mean? There must be something there that's made him go, okay, I'll stay. Maybe there's some financial incentive. But again, I agree with you. It's really hard to see how, unless he is the guy who's going to back up Aubameyang if Lacazette goes, it's very hard to see how he gets game time given his limited experience of top flight football.
I mean, maybe the selling point was Lacazette's going to go. You're going to go out on loan. Mm-hmm. Aubameyang's in his mid-30s and, you know, was obviously very savvy re-signing that we did. The less said, the better. And you're the guy that we see being the heir apparent to those two. And I mean, you know, there's one thing. When I was 20, I went and lived in Paris for a little bit and I loved it, but I was homesick. And I think we forget sometimes these are kids who may find going to Germany as a teenager away from everything they know scary. And if the club you grew up in that is literally your home and everything you've known as a footballer says, we'll pay you a really nice wage to be patient and become the guy down the road, you may feel that that's more comfortable for you. And I understand that we sometimes look down at kids who won't get out of their comfort zone. I know there was an era in England where you criticized some kids who weren't willing to go overseas and try their talents there where they had more opportunity, but easier said than done. When you were 18, sure, did you want to go, you know, live in a foreign country? It's not so easy, you know?
Yeah, if I was a brilliant footballer, maybe, but like, I think the flip side of that is that, you know, it's no longer, there are players who, have demonstrated a clear pathway to serious career progression by doing that.
Jadon Sancho?
Jadon Sancho, like perfect example. You know, here's a guy who wasn't getting picked for Man City. He said, no, I'm not having it. I'm going to Dortmund. He's developed. He's played regularly. He's sensational. He's coming back and he's going to join Manchester United. He's got everything he wants in terms of Premier League football, in terms of his career, his salary, his all of it, his profile. He's in the England squad. I know he hasn't played a great deal, but, you know, I think there are examples there for young players that if they believe in themselves, it's not a case that you're, okay, I'm going to go to Germany and then all of a sudden I'm scratching around in the Cypriot second division or something like that, you know. So I do think there is an attractiveness there. There must have been some conversation with Balogun about, if not guaranteed playing time, a definite development plan that would enable him to get some playing time in the future. And I think your scenario where if you say, look, even if Lacazette stays another year, he leaves at the end of his contract, Aubameyang is going to be 33 at that point. You know, we are going to need a striker, go on loan, score the goals, and maybe you come back and you can stake a claim for that place alongside someone else, because it's not unreasonable to think that maybe next season we don't have either Aubameyang or Lacazette.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know I'm out of time. I'm going to ask you three word answer quick hitters, because I'm going to maximize every last second. One is Smith Rowe sailed to Villa. Do you have any worry at all?
No.
Yeah, me too.
No, other than simply because, like, if they do, they have demonstrated a fatal lack of understanding and ambition.
It doesn't make any sense.
About football club. So it simply cannot happen.
You're going to spend twice that much to replace him with someone who might not even be as good and is in your academy and more wages. Doesn't make sense. Joe Willock, do you think he'll be sold or kept?
Kept.
Last one, Reece Nelson. Does he exist? Can you prove it?
Yes, because I've seen him half naked on Instagram. And if that is not...
Leave it there. Andrew's on Twitter. I mean, I don't know what else to say, but no, that's good. I feel for Reece Nelson, but it looks like he's his Arsenal.
I think he'll go.
And there's not much of a path to the positions he'd want to play anyway. Andrew's on Twitter at Arsblog. Thanks, man.
My pleasure. Thanks as always. And thanks to all the Arsenal Vision crew.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And welcome to steal any of them other than myself anytime. We are going to take a break to straighten your teeth. And when we come back, unfortunately, Tim and Paul will be here. But it should be fun, so stay with us. There's a specialist for just about everything, right? When my car breaks down, I go to a mechanic. When there's a problem with my shower, I call a plumber. When I shower. So when you want to get your uneven, crooked teeth fixed, you see an orthodontist. They're the specialists. And that's what sets Candid, the invisible, comfortable, and removable aligners, above the rest. While poorly reviewed or insanely priced clear aligner companies use general dentists, Candid only works with orthodontists. And with Candid, the same orthodontist who created your plan is with you from start to finish, so you never have to wonder how you're doing. Your treatment is prescribed and closely monitored remotely by a licensed orthodontist who's an expert in tooth movement. You can book an appointment at a Candid studio near you or do everything from the comfort and convenience of your own home. The average Candid treatment is just 6 months. You'll start seeing results way before that, and it costs thousands less than traditional braces. And with your aligner treatment, you'll even get Candid's teeth whitening free. Candid can help you get the straighter, brighter smile you've always wanted. Right now, you can save $75 on your Candid starter kit when you get started from home. Go to candidco.com/vision and use code VISION. That's candidco.com/vision, code VISION. candidco.com/vision, code VISION. Take advantage of this limited time offer to save. All right, we're back, and now we have the main group, sans Clive, who is not fit enough to start, but we do have Tim, and you can find him on Twitter at Stoberto. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
And Paul, you can find him on Twitter at Pause My Pants. Hello, Paul.
Woohoo!
So Tim, who is our day out correspondent, back when days out were a thing, well, they're a thing again, and he had one, and Clive had one. He's not fit enough to start, but, you know, his playing days were a few years ago now. Tim, even though there's been a year pandemic, you're still in shape for the day out, and it seems like you're recovering okay. So congratulations, obviously,
Thank you.
In order. We can maybe touch on a little of the controversy surrounding what happened there and my take on how maybe overblown it is. But first, let's just hear about it. You went to Wembley. You went to the game. Mm. What was the build-up like, the match like? And then based on your social media, the trying to get home part wasn't so fun.
Yeah, London, the city that very much sleeps. As you can probably tell from my voice, which is still recovering, it was absolutely fantastic. And it wasn't just fantastic because, you know, England won a big game at Wembley, which, you know, a game that big literally hasn't happened in my lifetime. But it was more the kind of, and this is always true anyway, that it's the communal experience that makes it. But the communal experience on the back of 18 months where communal experiences haven't existed. Mm. And you know, for many people still don't exist and won't exist for a while. You know, this isn't post-pandemic by any means. And there are lots of people who are still vulnerable. And they're, you know, the virus hasn't gone anywhere. So I think it's important to put it in that context. However, there were 60,000 people at Wembley. That's the biggest, I think I'm right in saying the biggest sporting event in terms of, well, definitely in terms of the size of the actual event. I mean, there were 28 million, I think, that watched it on TV in England as well. But certainly the biggest kind of number of spectators that have gathered for any event, I think, since the start of the pandemic. And that in itself was just absolutely enormous. I got to Wembley about 4 o'clock, and me and a couple of friends just sat on Wembley Way with some beers. And that, even that part of the day was just great, because it was like, wow, when was the last time we were around this many people? And, you know, obviously there was a, you know, hashtag carnival atmosphere and everything like that, and a severe lack of outdoor toilets as well.
I mean, I don't want to be crass here, but that's what the underwear is for, right? It's very absorbent, so that's fine.
Well, let's just say the local plant life was well watered during the few hours that we were there. And then, you know, inside the stadium. And so you feel maybe a little bit more confident anyway, just because like everyone has to produce a negative test within 48 hours of entering the stadium and things like that. But it's amazing how quickly you pick up the cues of being in a mass, like a throng of people again, and like talking to people. Because I didn't go on my own, I didn't travel there on my own, but I sat on my own. And just being in the concourse before and having a beer and just talking to people and talking to strangers again in a way that I haven't been able to really for 18 months or so. And then hugging people next to you randomly when goals go in and things like that. And then just little cues I've missed, like going to the toilet at half time and everyone cramming in and smoking and stuff like that, and just, you know, my throat being hoarse, that hasn't happened in such a long time. And so, you know, even leaving aside the actual enormity of the occasion and how it turned out and everything, just that kind of communality of it. And they played Sweet Caroline at the end, and I know some people have a problem with that song, but just being in a stadium where, well, there are a few thousand Danes, to be fair, so I won't say all 60,000 were singing Sweet Caroline, but just like that kind of air punching, singing along, you know, people just really enjoying it. And I do think that pandemic context is hugely important and has actually really added and enhanced this tournament. I think with the kind of addition of crowds, I think it's made us all realize how much crowds add. And yeah, I got a major dose of that last night, and I just realized all the things I loved about being in a crowd that I'd forgotten.
Yeah, I watching it at home, obviously, it's better with a crowd. I'm curious about something. You know, obviously, I'm invested in it because I'm sort of rooting for England, and I also kind of felt bad for Denmark. Like, there was a tension there from a narrative standpoint, but I was rooting for England, for you, for Clive, for, you know, all the friends I have who support England, Tim Clark and Phil Costa, obviously, who are doing the Euro Daily with. But, like, is it almost less nerve-wracking being at the ground than sitting alone at home watching on TV? Yep. Because the energy, the sort of febrile energy of the crowd gives you a way to shed some of that nervousness in a way that you can't just sitting at home, like biting your fingernails.
Yeah, definitely. It's weird. I think it kind of giveth and taketh away at the same time, because you're right. You can kind of scream and shout and leap around with people and things like that. But at the same time, so I think in like the extreme moments, it really is. But I tell you when it really hit me is when, you know, when the penalty was given and that thing happened that I find always happens when penalties are given, people start celebrating and that makes me extra nervous. Like, no, don't celebrate. Like, you know, for me, penalty spot, yep, quick fist pump and then refocus. But like loads of people in crowds just go mad. And that makes me even more nervous. And the run up for the penalty, I think that made me feel more nervous because I could feel everyone's nervous energy. But at the same time, you're right, you can expel it far easier. Because if I'd have been sat here watching at home, either slash on my own or with my wife who's Brazilian and therefore isn't really invested, then I wouldn't have celebrated nearly as much. Whereas when it actually went in, or the penalty rebound anyway, you know, there was that big, like, you know, I had like foolishly I bought sunglasses with me because I needed them earlier in the day, and obviously they went south somewhere, and you're just like kind of leaping around, and someone was next to me who was like slightly annoying, to be honest. But like once the goal went in, it didn't matter, and you start like hugging everyone, and you know, which might probably still be advised, but you know, it just felt like one of those nights. Like it's I'm a complete glory hunter when it comes to England. I think international tournaments are like Christmas, basically. Like everyone enjoys Christmas, and you can be like a bit cynical about it if you want, and I certainly used to be, but then you just think, do you know what, people enjoy this, let them enjoy it. Like I don't see loads of like Christians going around going, oh, I don't see you in church every Sunday.
it's you know, it's holiday for everyone, mate.
Exactly, it is what it is. But
it's kind of like, well, yeah, I mean, all you have to do is turn on the TV right now and see the people who have clearly never watched a football match in their life talking about the England team like they host their own podcast, for example. So yeah,
well, yeah.
Tim, can I add
that's fine.
Can I add as a Catholic from Dublin that back in the day you most certainly did have people saying, I haven't seen such and such a church this week.
True.
Well, last thing, Tim, I mean, it is the unfortunate reality of social media that the worst things get amplified. And so whenever England succeed in a tournament or in a tournament, I feel like England, even more than other countries, are a victim of social media passing around videos of men behaving badly. Now, that's not to say that men don't behave badly and that England fans haven't behaved badly. But, you know, as usual, in the wake of this, there's some videos that are a little cringy. Having been there and been in the crowd and made your way home from the game, do you find that that is social media doing its typical thing of amplifying the limited amount of bad behavior? I mean, is it like for you, do you see mostly good people behaving well, celebrating the right way, enjoying the occasion, mostly handling their liquor okay? Or do you see it being unfortunately stained a little bit by behavior that you'd rather not be witness to?
Yeah, and look, I'm not a veteran of England games by any means. My impression, like, so last night I saw very, very little of that. There was just one point where like we were waiting for the tube and the no surrender chant went up, and it was, you know, it was a load of guys who like probably weren't even born when like the troubles were happening. And it's like, I bet you don't even know what IRA stands for. But you know, there
was like
a tiny bit
of that. That's where they put their money to avoid tax liability. Sorry. Oh, that's a Roth IRA. Never mind, sorry.
And it is so like I do think there's probably a difference between like last night, which would have had a lot more fans, like, you know, probably me, who are there for Christmas, as it were. Whereas I probably get the impression that if you go to like Slovenia for a qualifier and there's a smaller, more hardcore band, like you can't deny that that element exists within the England fan base. You just can't. It is there. The question is, to what extent is it there? To what extent is it a minority, majority, small minority, large minority, whatever? And I'm not an expert on that because I don't go to enough England games. But last night, like overwhelmingly just not like that at all. And actually opposite me, there was, you know, there were some Danish fans on our train, and there was like a young England fan kind of having a chat with this Danish guy, kind of looked in his late 40s, early 50s. And the England fan, you know, he said he was 22. And it was just that, because, you know, like everyone's a bit euphoric. And like when I was queuing for the tube, there was a Danish couple next to me, and all the England fans kept coming over to them and shaking hands with them and stuff. And I could observe that they were not like annoyed by it, but, you know, like as much as you're euphoric And because you're in such a good mood, you're just like, oh, and you really just want to go and shake their hands and say, you know, commiserations and all of that. But at the same time, they're the opposite. They're really pissed off. And therefore, like, I'm sure they completely appreciate the gesture and the context of it and everything. But at the same time, they're probably a bit like, I don't really want to talk to anyone at the moment. Yeah, I'm already surrounded by the supporters of the team who's won. And really, I kind of just want to slink off home and forget about it. But, there was lots of, like, certainly around me and everything I saw was, like, overwhelmingly positive. And like, the other thing I'd say that really helped make the atmosphere, there was actually quite a strong Danish contingent. They had a whole end. And, the Danes and English fans just mixed wonderfully. But you need that opposition support as well. And that's one of the things. I know I'm going to say this because I'm biased and I live in the city and it meant I could go to the game easily. But that is one of the benefits of London hosting, semi-finals and finals, because there's such a diaspora here. There will be loads of Italians in the stadium on Sunday, and that will be great because there are loads of Italians in London. It's a bit like when they hold the Copa America in the US. I think that makes a hell of a lot of sense because of the South American diaspora there. Mm-hmm. And that really helped make it as well, because we had like a nice engaged Denmark enders and it was just great.
Yeah, that is great. And I mean, it is sort of the interesting tension in some ways of the people who say, oh, I'm sick of plastic fans and tourists and I long for the old days. And then there's that tension of like, well, the old days of doing jingoistic or racist chants and vandalizing property and punching each other in the face, like that old days, or, you know, and I get it. Like, you want people that really genuinely support the team, but also ideally you want people that genuinely support the team in a good mannered way and make it a great day out for everyone. Seems like that's what you're saying it was. And I think it is unfortunate that on social media, you can have a video of a girl getting Mason Mount's shirt and losing her mind with joy that gets like 3,000 likes, and you can have a larger gentleman with his shirt off behaving badly that gets 40,000 shares with a bunch of people tutting. And so that's just the way social media works. But, you know, just hearing you talk about that experience of being in the crowd and getting a hoarse voice and, you know, a sore throat and sharing a hug. And I am a hugger. So, you know, Paul, be prepared when we get to Vegas, my man, because like, many hugs will be shared and given. And that's my thing. That's why. Yeah, no, that's why I'm so excited about this event too, because like, I miss that. I need that. I want to be surrounded by crowds of people who just want to celebrate Arsenal and watch the game and punch the air. And, you know, and especially not having access to the Emirates and being able to go over there right now to be able to do that for a Chelsea game that weekend. They're like, yeah, I'm really excited to share drinks and hugs and chants and cheers and watch the games together and have
I'm
that
going
experience.
To be there for you. Do not worry about it. I'm very handsy.
Yeah. Well, we're booked. Your room's booked. My room's booked. Flights are booked. We're booked.
Same room.
I mean, they have a connecting door, so we can act like we're not sharing the room. You know, plausible deniability. But so, look, let's shift slightly from the occasion of the day to two things that I think we really can talk about with that game, and then we'll shift into some transfer rumors for the hashtag clicks. One of them is just the controversy of the penalty award, and I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but like the level of outrage about it is interesting, and I wonder if it would be the same if it wasn't for England in particular, if it hadn't happened at Wembley. I understand people that think it wasn't a penalty. I am more of the opinion that it probably isn't one. But if you've ever listened to this podcast before, you will know that I'm the kind of person who, when Arsenal lose and there's a bad refereeing decision in the game, I tend to be the guy who says, you still have to go win the game. You have to do enough to deserve to win. And we always talk about variance, Paul, in football. It is a low-scoring sport. And so if you play in a way where the variance can come back to bite you, that is dangerous. And I think, you know, Denmark in the second half, particularly where they looked a little fatigued and they sat back, England were in the penalty box, I think 57 penalty box touches or something. When you touch the ball 57 times in the opposition penalty box, you increase the risk that a soft penalty be awarded, that something will go against you, a random handball, and that's the variance of football. So while I fully feel for Denmark, a story that was wonderful and a penalty award that is harsh, A, it didn't lose them the game. England were still very much in it. Denmark looked out on their feet, and it's possible they would have won in extra time or in penalties anyway. But two, you know, I mean, credit to England. I think they had, without the penalty, like 3 expected goals or something, 57 penalty box touches at some point. You know, you kind of have to hold your hands up and say it's a harsh way for it to happen, but it's probably a fair outcome. Is that how you see it as well, or do you feel more of the injustice?
I don't really feel the injustice. If it had been one moment in the game where, you know, it was the one time England got into their box. But I'm with you. You get into the box that often with Sterling traveling at speed. Like the first view I had of it live, I thought, oh, that's a penalty. Now you can look at it from multiple angles, and there's a spectrum of angles depending on which one you look at it. And yes, they do a VAR review. There's contact. There's double contact in the end. He was looking for it, but then the best attackers look for a penalty. He was beginning to go down, but then the best attackers, that's what they do to you. They terrorize defenses in the box. We may wish this game was black and white and adjudicated in a way in which it was always fair, always equal, but it's not. It never was. It never will be. I mean, even looking at it with the different angles and nationalities and prejudices aside, you might have most people saying, well, maybe technically at the end of it, it's not a penalty. But you still have plenty of people saying, no, I still think it is a penalty, or, you know, a shades of it. So at the end of the day, you come down to a decision on the day, and Sterling was excellent in that movement into the box. I think the attacker has the prerogative, the advantage to cause the situation in general, whether it's, you know, I hate it and it upsets me. It doesn't mean I don't kind of accept that somebody like a Kane getting into your penalty box time and time again, like the ones where there's no contact, the ones where it's totally fabricated, that's another matter. But if there's a contact incoming and the guy makes the most of it, I mean, that's the game. That's what an attacker does. He brings you onto him. He puts you in a dangerous situation where you expose yourself. And he takes advantage of it.
I don't need to be in a dangerous situation to expose myself, but go ahead, sir.
Always with the smut, Elliot.
roll reversal Thursday.
Yeah.
Like, it's what you do. Like, if the guy wasn't any good, they would have backed off him. Right. If the guy didn't have them on toast, they would have been back a foot from him. They would have guided him up. But he's just like, he terrifies defense.
What was the game? Was it Wolves where we're dominating and David Luiz gets the really, really soft penalty and red card?
Yep.
Wolves, right? Right at the end of the first half. That's an example of where you say, it feels a little harsh, and it cost us the game. Now, ironically, it didn't. It was the second sending off that cost us the game. But my point is, that's one where you could say that refereeing decision totally changes what the outcome looked like it was heading to be, and I just don't feel that way with this, you know?
Yeah, it's like you just look at the amount of possession, amount of threat into and around the box. It was kind of, it was one of these that felt like it was coming. Now, it might not have come, but like he did it to them. It's not like one of these where he's like at the corner of the box, heading in the wrong direction, looking to pass off to the touchline. He was coming straight at them, and they had to throw players in his way, which he had to slalom through, and he decided not to slalom through them. And he went down, and there was contact, and that's the way the game is. And you mightn't love it, but that's what the best players do.
Yeah. Refereeing.
They do it to you.
Yeah, you're absolutely. Look, refereeing decisions are the quintessential example of survivorship bias, because you remember the bad calls. You don't remember the non-calls that went for you or the calls that went for you. So, like, I don't think it's totally clear that it should have been a free kick for the free kick that Denmark scores to take the lead. There was one where Kane pokes the ball sort of past the defender at the top of the box and the defender clips his leg. Now the defender's in front of him. So I think that's the referee opts not to make the call there. I wonder if this was half a penalty plus half a penalty equals a whole penalty, if there was some of that going on. But I mean, it's just the point that I feel for Denmark. Of course I do. What a wonderful story it was. And not just a story. They were an excellent team that played well. I think they were outplayed in this game, and I think the outcome seems fair, and I think the final is going to be incredible. And with that having been said, I think we can start to shift it to a more Arsenal focus. You know, we've talked about it a little bit already, but let's get your take on it, Tim. I mean, when Bukayo Saka got picked for the team, I was disappointed because I thought, now he won't get a summer off, and it's not like he's going to play anyway. I mean, Mount, Grealish, Foden, Sancho, Sterling, DCL, Kane, you know, like, he, you know, Rashford, he's not going to get on. So just give him the summer off. And instead, he's become the memeable, lovable star boy of the tournament in some ways. And that's probably more in the Arsenal circles than anywhere else. But, I mean, he has played an important role in the latter stages of this tournament. He is instrumental in the equalizer, even if he doesn't get it exactly right. And I'll have a word on that in a minute. I mean, it really is, I think, potentially a boon for Arsenal, because what he's lacking in rest, I think the confidence of playing under such high stakes and having so much responsibility put on him can only accelerate his development. How much have you enjoyed it, and how much do you think it can come to benefit Arsenal?
Yeah, I've hugely enjoyed it. It was possibly, well, one of my favorite moments of last night was when he went off and got a big standing ovation. And it was, you know, it's just like, yeah, everyone sees the player that we've seen now. And I think the reason he's kind of muscled his way into that team, I'm with you, Elliot. I kind of thought he might not even play a minute. Mm-hmm. In this tournament, you know, he might get on for a couple of minutes at the end of a game. But the reason I think he's muscled his way into the team is because he provides that balance, because particularly against the kind of the stronger opposition like Denmark are, there's that kind of, because sometimes Southgate can go to a back three and sometimes he goes to 4-2-3-1. But when you play Saka, you can kind of, it's kind of like not a halfway house, but you know what I mean? It's like, well, if I play Saka, I can play four at the back, because the way he plays is almost wing back-ish.
Can I stop you for a second, though, to say something that's very out of character for me? People know I'm not totally off the fence on Arteta yet. I'm not really sure. I've had my big doubts, but like, I think there are two credits to Arteta here. One, just moving Saka from left to right, because if he had stayed as a left winger, he doesn't play in this tournament at all. Moves him to the right where he thrives and becomes important for England. But also, is it maybe a testament to the fact that Arteta demands that his players understand their positional responsibilities, know where they need to be on the pitch, off the ball, on the ball, in the defensive phase, in the attacking phase, that then leads him to become an asset for Southgate, who can trust putting him out there, getting the attacking aspects of the game that he needs from him, but knowing he'll be in the positions he needs to in the other phases of play?
Yeah, definitely. And you see that with the equalizer. You know, he knows to make the run in behind when Kane's there. And that's the thing, because I'm sure that mainly the reason he's being played is because of his ability to drive with the ball, which we see time and again. He's just so good on the half turn and holding people off and fending them off and just getting the ball down the pitch. And it's almost like, and you know, he's being picked ahead of Grealish to do that. And that's because he does his business going the other way. But I think mainly the kind of idea is Kane and Sterling are basically a strike partnership. They're basically a front two for England. So you need that link. And Mason Mount provides it a bit, but what they've got with Saka is Mason Mount kind of provides it from the left, that ability to drive and to carry, albeit he does it a little bit more off the ball. But with Saka, you know, England are quite a counter-attacking team. So, you know, Saka picking the ball up on the halfway line with his back to the fullback and driving inside, you know, he did that time and time and time again. And I think Southgate realizes what a valuable weapon that is for a counter-attacking team. But for the goal as well, he knows to make the run. Like, that's the kind of run that Sancho would make. That's the kind of run that, you know, Sterling might make as well. And you know, getting that cut back again, which is a favourite kind of England goal. And that bodes really well for Arsenal as well, because I'm certain that's the type of goal that Arteta wants Arsenal to score. And I'm sure Arteta looked at that equaliser last night and he kind of thought, there's my boys. That's Saka making the run in behind, squaring for a tap in for Sterling. Albeit I know it was an own goal in the end, but you know, Arteta must have been looking at that and thinking, yeah, that's the ghost of my coaching past and the ghost of my coaching future meeting there. And it is just, I'm so, so happy for him, because he's such a good player, but like such a nice character as well. And I think you always get, I mean, nowadays in the social media age, you call it memeable, as you referenced. And we got that a little bit in the last World Cup with Harry Maguire, you know, the meme of him talking to his, I don't know if it's wife or girlfriend. And that became a really popular meme. And now it's kind of Saka who's going to get that off the back of this tournament. And I would anticipate that when he plays his first game of the season, he'll get a round of applause off the opposition fans as well.
A young up-and-coming academy player for Arsenal who's starring for England riding an inflatable unicorn through the sky is it's going to get memed. And oh, by the way, no apologies. Brandon McKenna took his stylus, went to his iPad, hand drew a rendering of it, threw it on a psychedelic background and said, we're putting this on mugs, shirts and hoodies. And I said, phone case, I said, put it everywhere. Put on everything, because I want one of all of them. So if you want that, you can go to arsenalvisionpodcast.com and you'll see them right on the homepage there. You can click shop, but they are awesome. Brandon designed them all by hand, so credit to him at Arsenal Illustrator. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the, I know quite a lot of people have got this, their profile on Twitter at the moment, but someone's like mocked it up over the three lions.
Yeah, of course. There's so many ways you can do it. And I mean, it's a must have because, I mean, he's a player who's going to be at Arsenal for a long time. He's so wholesome. I think that's the thing, too. I never felt this way about Jack Wilshere. I loved Jack Wilshere, but he was a bastard. But he was our bastard. But I loved him. Never felt this way about Cesc Fabregas. Loved Cesc Fabregas, but he was a bastard. He was a shit-talking, pizza-throwing bastard. But Kaio Saka's like you. He's like your child. Like he's lovable and cuddly, and there's just something so sweet about him. He is an assassin, a stone-faced killer on the pitch, but often he's just, there's this sweetness. And so it makes you just, I don't know, him on an inflatable unicorn. Like, I mean, that is really it. We described it, by the way, on the website as a mythical being of immense power and also an inflatable unicorn. So
I had it tattooed on my winky.
Yeah. Good.
And man, does that unicorn inflate.
Oh, good, super. So now opposite day is over now. We've returned the proper alignment on the podcast.
I have retaken my crown.
Thank you. Yep. Good. Let's talk about that. And by the way, there was the internet loves discourse. So one of the discourse things from the people who are salty because it's not Sancho starting or it's not Foden starting was, well, Saka's first touch isn't good and the pass is late and he gets lucky. It's an own goal. And it's like, that's football. Like no one gets it perfect all the time. Oh, by the way, Kane missed his penalty. Right? He gets lucky and he gets a rebound. Sterling missed from point blank range 2 minutes before that Saka quote unquote assist. So like even the best players screw up. It's his runs in behind. And this is what I want to focus on, Paul. One thing that Arsenal needs is more goals. And one thing Arsenal needs to be better at is breaking down low blocks. What makes Saka really special to me off the ball? On the ball, I don't think one defender can stop him. And I think that is a really unique and important trait because when you have to bring a second defender over, everything changes for the other attackers. But the other thing is his runs in behind, even against low blocks, even when there isn't as much space. Now, I realize that one, it's not as deep, but there were other runs he made where he got in behind, even against low blocks. Is that a superpower of his that we underrate? The ability to find space in behind, even low blocks, and timing the runs excellently? Because it's sort of what made Aubameyang a superstar, and I think Saka has a little of that.
Yeah, he's so, so smart. And particularly on that run, I mean, I don't know what the criticism of what he did on that run was.
Because if you freeze frame it, when the ball comes to him, Sterling is wide open to have it slid across the box. Because as you know, we can play football with frozen frame moments in time as opposed to running at full speed in a semifinal, trying to control the ball in front of 64,000 people.
Holy shit. Mm-hmm. His run is just so good. Perfect angle, perfect timing. What I love about it is that it's basically he knows the moment, and Kane's kind of got a no look pass where he just bangs it through the gap, and it's brilliant by Kane, but it means him and Saka are totally dialed in. And when you look at the front three of Sterling, Kane, and Saka, I mean, what an odd couple. Or threesome.
Trio. It's a thruple, they call that.
Yeah, thruple. And you look at that and you're like, that probably is the best English three. And look at the difference in everything with them in terms of what they bring. The kind of this weird role Kane's evolving into, where he's really a 10 starting at the 9 spot, doing really clever things, dropping in. And Saka's the guy keying off it. And they're just totally on the same wavelength. I thought in the first 10 minutes as well, when England looked pretty good, they started out, they do this pressing early in the first and second half kind of thing. And Mount and Saka, for me, were the guys doing it. Saka's so good in tight spaces. He's like, you give him a narrow corridor on the wing and he'll find a way. So he wasn't getting much space. Between him and Walker, they kept Mailer really quiet. That'll be the attacking wing for Italy, or has historically been with Insigne there. So that's going to be a very interesting wing. And then you look at the Neville comments today. I don't know if you saw them, but he's basically been pushing for Sancho or Rashford to start ahead of him on the basis that Saka's been great. Okay, Gary. But it's the final, and you need somebody who can make an out-to-in run and connect with Sterling.
Saka and Sterling had a great I mean, like, that was one of the principal things that they were doing well, switching flanks, connecting with each other. I mean, what's he talking about?
Like, you could not have done a more perfect run, connect on the same wavelength. It's going to be really interesting. I thought it was, as well, the, you know, Tim talked about the big cheer and appreciation he got when he came off, and then the hug from Southgate. Like, you can read too much into stuff, but that hug said, listen, I feel really terrible taking you off because you don't deserve to be taken off, but this was the plan. It's time to get Grealish on.
Well, he was coming off a knock too, right? I mean, we don't know if that played a role in it, but, you know, he's the most junior guy out there and he's suffering a knock. And so, yeah.
Yeah, but it was very much the formula. Bring Grealish on the left, switch Sterling to the right. It's a different look. The team kind of knows the drill. But like the hug he got, of appreciation from Southgate, I don't know. I think, like, how do you not play him? Sancho didn't play well enough to start in the final, and Rashford ain't great from the right, and he's just, you know, does he have that same understanding with these guys? I don't know. It's going to be very interesting.
This is the hug podcast. We talked a lot about hugging.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm feeling the need for a hug right now. Digital hugs coming all around. Well,
I don't know with the star on. Boy. Oh, yeah, sorry.
We all are. We all are, frankly. Yeah. So let's use this as a stick to beat Arteta with, Tim, just for a second. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But
yes,
no, but let's talk about Willian. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But let's sort of talk about Arteta. So the interesting thing with Southgate is, I don't think Southgate is much of a coach in terms of, I don't know that tactically he's all that astute. We know that international coaching and club coaching are very different things. And so I'm loath to make a comparison. Yep. But I think if there is a thing that Southgate has gotten completely right from the outside looking in, it's the man management. Keeping a load of stars happy, especially at the attacking end, where you've got a lot of people that have a claim to a position. Finding ways to make it work. I mean, I don't think that Rice and Phillips should both be starting, personally. I don't think tactically that works against lesser opposition in particular. I think there's a ball progression problem there. But, like, everyone seems happy. Everyone seems on board. Everyone seems to be rowing in the right direction. You can read too much into that. I mean, maybe Jadon Sancho's steaming. Who knows? But, like, they all see, you know, winning helps too. But is there a part of this, you know, as you reflect on sort of what you'd like to see from Arteta, he's got similar issues. I mean, what is Southgate facing? He's facing a situation where Sancho could absolutely claim he has a right to start, and Foden too, and Rashford too, and Saka too, and DCL, you know, not even making match day squads, you know, has a claim to say, well, I could be a great plan B. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of players in there that might, especially in the attacking end, feel hard done by. Doesn't seem like that's happening. Arteta's got a situation now with, I reluctantly reference Willian again, but Pepe and Saka and Smith Rowe and Aubameyang and Lacazette, if he sticks around, and Gabriel Martinelli, certainly an important one that we have to bring in. And maybe we are adding one more to that group. And that's going to be, with no European football, having to keep all of those players happy, content, getting the playing time they need to progress in their career, but doing what's best for Arsenal. I mean, Southgate seems to have that knack. Is that the next thing Arteta's going to have to make sure he has this season, given that it's starting to look like a fun but crowded sort of attacking platoon for Arsenal that all have to be kept happy with a lot less games?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we spoke about this a little bit, didn't we, with Smith Rowe as well. Like, what kind of number 10 are you buying, guys? And what's that going to do to my playing time? There is definitely that. And how do you get Pepe and Martinelli and Aubameyang into the same attack? Because I think that maybe those three are our best attackers. Although, you know, if you put Saka in midfield, say, but even talking like that, like, it's not, but then how do you get Smith Rowe in? Like, Yeah, I'm like, it's a pleasing amount of depth. It's a good problem to have.
I think only Arsenal fans worry about this to this degree. You won't see a lot of big clubs too worried about having too many good players, you know?
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Like, it's not a problem. And it's also why we can let Willian go and we don't even have to replace him, because we've got the numbers already. So something that struck me with Southgate, he spoke about this, about his desire to involve everyone. Because he did it at the 2018 World Cup. So like he got a bit of criticism because at the end of that group stage, England were already through, and he kind of put out a second 11 against Belgium. And he kind of said that his rationale for that wasn't so much to rest players, but it was to keep players feeling involved. And you'll see, the quarterfinal against Ukraine, he makes 5 subs. But like, he brings on guys who probably aren't going to be like Jude Bellingham. Like Bellingham, that was his only appearance, I think, and he's probably not going to come on in the final. But like, it just involves them. And he spoke about an experience he had at the 2002 World Cup. So he went to, I think, 4 major tournaments with England. 96, played every minute of every game. 98, I think he might have played every minute of every game. 2000, he was heavily involved. And then he went to 2002 and he didn't play at all, and he didn't get on. And there were 5 or 6 players in that, because Svenjurin Eriksson did that very, like, this is my first 11 and these are my 3 substitutes. Sorry, everyone else. And he spoke about what a negative experience that was, not just for him, but for the other 4 or 5 players who didn't get on and knew they weren't going to get on. And he kind of said that that just disengages the whole, like, if you've got 4 or 5 or 2 or 3 unhappy players, that has an impact on the entire group, not just on those players. And so it's quite a savvy thing that Southgate's done there. And you'll notice in his last 2 post-match interviews, he has immediately referenced the players he's had to leave out of the squad. It's the first thing he said. He's also done quite a nice job of, because you have to leave 3 players out of the match day squad, he's rotated those players as well. So it's not the same 3 players all of the time. So there is quite a lot going on there. I do think, to spin it back to Arteta, on the point of the place being happier, I do think he's got some very lived experience of that, and he's referenced that himself about, you know, he's hinted very broadly that some of the players that were kind of booted out of the door in January, you know, he spoke about how in the first half of the season that was quite difficult to manage, just having players who weren't involved and, you know, feeling with some level of justification, just disengaged from the whole thing. So I do think he should have enough lived experience of that now. And I do think that it is actually one of the things he did quite well with the attack last season. We had a conversation after, you know, after we beat Chelsea on Boxing Day, and then we thumped, and we beat Brighton, and we thumped West Brom. And because Smith Rowe had come in, and we thought, we've got our attack made now. And I said on one of those podcasts, but now he's got to involve the other attackers. He's got to involve Pepe. He's got to involve Martinelli. He can't just say, I've got my front three and that's the end of it. And to his credit, I don't think he did. So I do think that he may have some credit in the bank, but he's definitely got some experience there.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I also think, by hook or by crook, getting rid of Willian this summer would be such a boon. And again, even if you think Willian was more serviceable than people make out, it is a fairly crowded group. There is no construction of the universe I can think of, barring injury crisis, where Willian really should be playing this season, given the options we have and the players that we want to prioritize. And having him just sitting there not playing, I think, could become pretty bad pretty quickly. I mean, even moving on Lacazette, for that matter, I think would be helpful. And it's complicated by the fact that we may want to be bringing in another player in the sort of 8-10 role, which says, well, where's Smith Rowe going to go? How do Pepe and Saka shake out? Martinelli, who I think could be the most talented of all of them, has to get more playing time with fewer games this season. It is a difficult formula that he's going to have to solve. And that leads us, Paul, to the question of, will we go for someone in that 8-10 role? Because I think starting this summer, we were all like, we got to get Odegaard, or we got to get Buendia, or we got to get Aouar. We got to get a guy in that position. And as the summer's worn on, I've sort of come around to the idea that, like, well, Smith Rowe's kind of injury prone, but what if we let the, just roll the dice with Saka, Pepe, Martinelli, Smith Rowe, Aubameyang, and then if Lacazette and Willian are around, fine. and just see where that takes us with fewer games and hope it doesn't bite us. And I don't have a decision.
You lunatic.
Look, I know it's a risk, but you know, I like to take risks. I don't really worry. That's why my friends don't call me Whiskers. But I think this Awar link is interesting because this to me is a deal you do. And the reason this is the deal you do is James Madison at $60 million says every week starter on $140,000 a week, he needs to be a star right now. And I'm not sure that's quite who he is. Awar at €25 million with elite underlying metrics, a bit younger, and a guy you could probably tempt with $70,000 a week or $80,000 a week, says we can play him when we want. We can ease him in slowly. We can play him at 8. We can play him at 10. But like, he strikes me as the right combination of very high upside, very tolerable risk, doesn't necessarily have to block anyone's path. It just, it feels like the right combination of factors. It's almost too smart a deal. And therefore, we will do it because we're a very smart club and we don't make mistakes. What do you think?
So to the first part of the question, I think we will go for, and let's call it an attacking midfielder. And for the who it might be, well, I think it's interesting when you look at the three players we've been strongly linked with. Now, maybe the Awar thing is real or not, but it was certainly real last summer. And given that last summer was when it was kind of a clean sheet of paper, that would tell you that maybe Awar was very much the profile that Arteta saw adding to the team. There's been a lot of water under the bridge. Odegaard was here. He did really well. I don't know if that was the perfect profile that we wanted, or that's what it was available in January, and it worked really well for us. And then it worked well with Smith Rowe, because they're kinds of different kinds of attacking players, and Smith Rowe can play on the left, and they found an accommodation. And then we went for, or at least we put our hat in the ring for Buendia. Maybe we just wanted to keep him on the hook long enough to find out if Odegaard was coming or not, and we were hoping to go after him after the Euros. But if I take those three profiles, Buendia to me is almost between Awar, who's very much a toothpaste player, and attacking 8/10, but more an 8 than a 10. Got goals in him. He's kind of like Kevin De Bruyne as well, but maybe not quite as creative. But that kind of verticality, you could certainly see him playing in a midfield 3 with 2 8s. In a V shape, a kind of a Man City setup. He's going to get you in the box. He's going to get in the box. He carries, he dribbles. Very clever passer, really good balance, really good on the ball, won't lose it. So he's a really interesting profile, I think, Awar. Probably closest to what Arteta has wanted. But Odegaard, I think, gives us something more different to what we have in the squad now, because I don't think Arteta knew he had Smith Rowe last year, not as a starter, not as a key man he could rely on, a promising talent who might begin to contribute during the season, maybe. And now he's got a different challenge. He's got Smith Rowe, and Awar is just a little too similar to Smith Rowe. Now, Smith Rowe could play on the wing, but then we got Martinelli. We got Pepe to get in the lineup somewhere as well. So good problems to have. You can always do rotation. I think we want more of the creative. I think as well, Madison tends to play on that side a little bit too and is more Awar-like. So it'll be interesting to see who we start plumbing for. But Odegaard, an Odegaard type, makes the most sense to me because tends to play from the right and tends to be the more creative, more Ozil-like, more about assisting. And Awar is more about getting into the box, having a pop at goal, and being more vertical. So,
yeah, I'm so torn, right? Because
can I come back to one thing? Sorry. Like, we did make the mistake last year of not getting our attacking midfielder, and I wasn't as upset about it. I was like, oh, well, we got Partey. We'll find a way to configure it, and that was a travesty of an error.
To be fair, to be fair, it's because we had neither Odegaard or Smith Rowe, right? Like,
sure.
Like, once Smith Rowe came in, we beat Chelsea before Odegaard was ever there. So it's a point that we needed at least one of them. Whether and we needed two is another
issue. The lesson I took from that is you definitely need somebody all season long.
Yeah.
And if you think Smith Rowe can play 38 games, great. But I would not bet my managerial career at Arsenal on it. I'd want two options.
I don't disagree, but this is it, right? Madison and Odegaard are both going to be big fees, big wages.
Yep.
They're going to be one of the players in the team that you look to and say, he's our star. We paid for him like he's a star and he has to star for us. And that has ramifications both in terms of whether they're really good enough to be that. Odegaard has the potential but isn't there yet. Madison is in his prime. We know who he is. He's been playing on a good team in the Premier League and he's been producing good but not elite output. Do you want to make that guy your star on huge money? Whereas Aouar at 25 million euro, like his underlings are absolutely elite. Tim, I mean, I know people get sick of the data, metrics, underlings, all that, but like absolutely elite. As just a finishing thought here, is the combination of a price tag that is appealing, underlying metrics that suggest an elite ceiling, but then the versatility of being able to say he's young, he won't be on the biggest wages, we're not paying for him like a star, so we can fit him in, make him a really exciting option with Smith Rowe there, as opposed to bringing in the record-breaking fee, big wage, nailed-on star guy who's got to deliver that way.
He was 23 in June, just for those who haven't Googled it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it would make sense on a number of levels. I mean, Arsenal, you know, we talked about like, you know, do they roll the dice and not buy a number 10? And so, like, so one thing is clear. We're going to have to roll a dice somewhere this summer because we can't get everything done, whether it's right back. I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to be back up left back or number 10 or whatever, striker. There's going to be a gap somewhere, and we're just going to have to hope it's not exposed. The reason I'm quite attracted to the Aouar deal is basically everything you've just said there. Like, I think that basically the price is quoted. It's one of those that can't be disastrously wrong or go disastrously bad or be one of those players, you know, maybe a bit like, you know, Lacazette, where it's like, yeah, he's good. He's very good. But, you know, is he really what we need? Did we really need to spend 50 million on that player? And the other thing is, I think if you sign Aouar instead of, say, Madison, albeit I don't think Madison will happen, but I think that makes the Smith Rowe contract talks easier as well. Like, if you're bringing in, you know, a 25-year-old at 25 million and you're just saying, look, you're going to compete with this guy for a place, but, you know, come on. Back yourself a little bit.
Yeah, like, we're a big club doing big club stuff versus we bought a guy to block your path.
yeah, exactly. So I think it comes closer to that balance of kind of saying, look, we can't, like, if you're ambitious, Emil, and you want us to go where we want to be going, we have to buy another number 10. Like, we can't just leave that wide open just for you. Otherwise, we're not going to get past eighth place, and that doesn't suit either of us.
Yeah, no one wants to be there.
But with our, like, I just think it's that kind of, look, we bought this guy, and, you know, we might rotate the two of you, you'll compete for a place, but, you know, look, it's not dead set that he's going to come in against you, and you should back yourself against this guy. But at the same time, we get a good player in that position who can rotate within the front three. And if it's on, I'd go for it.
Yeah. And I mean, there might be people screaming, oh, but, you know, he's a jerk who wants PSG and Barca. That actually suits us great in a way, because if he comes in and he's excellent, and so is Smith Rowe, and in three seasons, Barca and PSG want him and he wants them, and he becomes our Coutinho, who we sell for 100 million, all the better in a way. Right? Like, you've got a guy that you're also trying to develop who's an academy kid you'd like to keep. Obviously, you always want to keep your good players, but if he gives us three really good seasons and goes for huge money, it works. We'll see what happens. Look, the Lokonga deal looks like it's about to happen. The Tavares deal looks done. The Ben White deal, we'll dive into it again more. I also have a specialist on Ben White coming on when the deal happens, assuming it does, at 50, 55 million. The business might be about to start to heat up, but it is worth saying that the players are back, they're training, they're with the club, and we've done the sum total of FA, which means that's not the Football Association, it's fuck all. So work to be done now if we want to have a real preseason with the real players there. And I realize the international players can't be. You'd love your new signings to get in the group as fast as possible. So hopefully we'll have more to discuss on that front. Tomorrow, we'll have a Patreon pod. We're also going to do a full Euro final preview. So you'll have that to get you through the weekend. And yeah, if you want to see Lekonga scouting video, Tavares scouting video, Ben White scouting video, and William Saliba scouting video, those are on the Patreon right now. If you want your inflatable unicorn content, just go to our website, click on the shop, and buy up everything Saka with riding an inflatable unicorn, because it's a beautiful thing. Pause on Twitter. Pause my pants. Thanks, pause.
It's coming home. It's coming home.
What's coming home are my arms around you when I hug you in Vegas, my man. Be ready for it. I'm a power hugger. Tim, I know you don't like hugs. It's probably the reason you're not coming to Vegas, and not at all to do with the fact that you can't be there. But Tim's on Twitter. Stilberto, thanks, Tim.
My pleasure as always.
I'm going to give you a cheeky hug sometime. My name is Elliot Smithy. Good luck, man. Twitter at Yankee Gunner. We love you so much. Denmark fans, sorry. England fans, happy for you. Everybody else, just glad to see that we're living in the world of Bukayo Saka. We love you, though. Hang in there. There's more to come. We'll talk to you after Arsenal 10 Transfer Window News.